Thanks for coming in, Mr. Mahoney. Do you have your member ID card?
Yep, I have it right here in the FEP Blue app, see?
Great.
It's awesome. The app can also help me find a provider and keep tabs on my deductibles.
Okay, can I...
Oh, yeah, and my out-of-pocket spending and visit limits, and I can call the nurse line.
I'm really glad it does all that, but I only need to see your member ID card.
Oh, that's it? Why didn't you say so?
Fearless is just one tap away. With the new FEP Blue app from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, you can access your health benefits on the go. Download it now at fepblue.org/app.
You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Locked On Seahawks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the fastest growing sports audio network in the world. This is Vincent Verhey of Football Outsiders, and I'm back talking your Seattle Seahawks and all the news around the NFL. Thanks for hanging out today, and let's hang out again tomorrow. Be sure you and your friends subscribe to the podcast because we are going to have some fun. We're going to talk to Aaron Freeman and Alan Sterk of Locked On Falcons. We're going to do a crosstalk section breaking down the Seahawks-Falcons playoff game this Saturday. I just finished the conversation, actually. It was a lot of fun. You're going to want to hear that. And that's the whole show. So before we get into that, let's go ahead and look at what else is going on around the Locked On Podcast Network today. Over at the mothership, Locked On NFL, Matt Williamson has looks at all the coaching hires around the league today. A bunch of teams getting new coaches. Also, odds and ends around the NFL, all the other news as we're here in the middle of the playoffs. Meanwhile, over at Locked On NFL Draft, Vinny Iyer of Sporting News is looking at O.J. Howard, the big tight end for Alabama. Also, the cornerback class that is coming into the league in 2017. And over at Locked On Redskins, you're going to want to listen to this show because the Rams hired a coach today named Sean McVay. Now, Sean McVay has been the Redskins offensive coordinator for the past couple of years, so the Locked On Redskins crew is going to look at which players and coaches might join him in the City of Angels. But the big news about that hire, frankly, it's big news for Seattle because a division rival hired a coach. But the big news about that coaching hire is that Sean McVay is 30 years old. 30! Not 31, not 32, 30! He turns 31 in a few weeks, I guess, but he's the youngest coach in modern history. He will almost certainly have players older than him next year. Most teams are going to have players older than him next year. It's going to be interesting to see if this works out. And, of course, as a Seattle fan, I hope it doesn't. Regardless, tune into Locked On Redskins to the breakdown on Sean McVay and who might join him in L.A. That is what's going on the Locked On Podcast Network. Be sure and check that out today. All right, with that business taken care of, let's get right into this. Here is the crosstalk segment with Aaron Freeman and Alan Sterk of Locked On Falcons. Enjoy.
Like how you doing, gentlemen?
I'd like to welcome you to the show and, enjoy talking with you and finding out some more information on the Seahawks team and what you think about this upcoming matchup. Alan, take it away.
So I think the obvious story is to talk about Earl Thomas. And look, there's been statistics, there's been articles about how much Seattle has missed him. From your perspective, Vincent, can you talk about his absence?
It's been huge. You don't go from the best safety in football to a backup safety without having big, noticeable drop-offs. The run defense has held up very well. They're still very good against the run. But the pass defense has had big problems. Again, giving up way more touchdowns than usual with way fewer interceptions. That's pretty bad. Giving up about a yard more per pass without Earl than they did with him. And the biggest, most obvious difference is right where you'd expect is in the deep middle area of the field where they, with Earl Thomas in the lineup for the past 6 years, they've usually given up 2 to 6 deep middle completions per year for most of the time he's been there. This year they gave up two deep middle completions in the 10 games he started, and then I believe 8 in the 7 games since, if I have that right. I'm sorry, 7 in the 7 games since. So it's gone from something that, deep middle completions have gone from something that never happened to the Seahawks to something that's happening fairly frequently, and opposing offenses are not afraid to try that. I mean, I think the Lions had 2 just in the second half of the playoff game. Whereas that used to be something that never happened when Earl Thomas was back there. They have not changed their scheme much. They're still really, really leaning heavily on cover 3 coverage, just going with Stephen Terrell in the deep middle, sometimes Cam Chancellor, sometimes Kelsey McCray. But they're just saying, this is what we do. And even though the one guy who makes it all work is gone, we're going to keep doing what we do.
Do you view Terrell as a bigger upgrade over McCray? Because I thought McCray was responsible for some of the breakdowns in the first matchup between both teams.
Oh, the first Falcons game, yeah, there was problems all over the place for Seattle, especially in that third quarter when you had Falcons running free in the end zone and Seahawks pointing and shouting at each other trying to figure out what was going on. It's Steven Terrell's job. He's the starting free safety now. They have mixed in, especially when Earl first got hurt, they mixed in some coverages where Terrell would be in the box and Cam Chancellor would be playing deep. McCray played some against Detroit when Terrell actually got knocked out of the game for a while. Is the biggest reason I brought him up. But the starting safeties for Seattle are right now Steven Terrell and Cam Chancellor.
So with all these questions in the secondary, it sounds like the Seahawks are more reliant on their front seven to basically, offset any issues they have on the back end. Do you feel like, particularly with a guy like maybe Frank Clark coming back, who didn't play in that first matchup, Seattle has enough up front to sort of offset whatever issues they may have on the back end?
The short answer to that question is no. I think that I don't think most people realize how good this Atlanta offense is. I think because the Falcons haven't had a lot of playoff success lately, and because they only won 11 games this year, only finger quotes, they're still the number two seed. But they weren't the Cowboys. The Falcons scored 540 points this year. That's a ton. That's a ridiculous amount of points. This is a great passing offense. They have a great quarterback, a great wide receiver. They're really deep at receiver. Their 4 and 5 receivers are better than most of the guys on the Rams, for example. They're both running backs are very good, and both running backs are very good running and receiving. This Falcons team can beat you in so many ways, and Seattle has made their money for most of this entire Pete Carroll regime. They've gotten their wins mostly from the back of their defense forward. It's been the secondary carrying the team most of the while. And the three diehards in the secondary have been Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, and Earl Thomas. And now Thomas is gone, and that changes everything. So how a team like this can match up with so many weapons Atlanta has is a challenge. And the answer is, can they put Matt Ryan on the ground? And Chris Richard basically said that much. The way to beat Atlanta is to sack the quarterback, because you can't cover everybody. You're not going to. You've got to pressure the quarterback, hit the quarterback, put him on the ground. And for, I think, about three of those quarters of the first time these teams play, they were able to do that. And they do have Frank Clark now, but they also had Earl Thomas then. So I expect a lot of pressure on Matt Ryan. I expect a lot of sacks on Matt Ryan. I don't know, 3, 4, 5 sacks, a bunch of hits. But I expect more open receivers than pressure on the quarterback, and I think Atlanta's still going to score a ton of points, as they usually do.
One of the more unbelievable stats this season I noticed was during the first half of that game, on 17 dropbacks, Ryan was sacked or hit on 11 of those in the first half against Seattle. So I thought they had a lot of success, obviously, blitzing, but at the same time, the Admiral really handled Ryan Schrader during the first half. And then, obviously, Bennett found some success as well. Obviously, Bennett also got taken out of that game. So I love what Seattle is doing up front, because, well, I noticed against Detroit, you have Bennett and Clark on the interior, and then Avril and Marsh on the outside. Have they just started doing this? Because I haven't noticed it all year.
They've always moved Bennett around a lot. If you go back and watch the first half of the Super Bowl against New England, I think, if I remember right, he had a hit from at least three different positions on the line on Tom Brady in the first half. And there's nothing they could do with him for 30 minutes. The four defensive ends thing, I don't think they've done that much, especially with, well, like I said, they've moved Bennett inside. I think the moving Clark inside is a new thing. But they definitely have, that quartet of pass rushers is better than most teams could have as a top four. That's if Seattle's going to get this win, those are the four guys who are going to need to get it done. And, let me clarify that. Those four and the linebackers, K.J. Wright and Bobby Wagner, who are also having excellent seasons. And Bobby Wagner has done a lot more pass rushing and blitzing up the middle than he has in years past, and he's had a lot of success with that too. So you may see Seattle blitz more than usual, especially in this game, trying to stop this offense. But it's an interesting mismatch both ways, because Seattle's pass rush seems to have a big edge over Atlanta's offensive line, and Atlanta's weapons, receivers and running backs, definitely have an advantage over Seattle's pass coverage.
Now, in that previous matchup, we saw Richard Sherman shadow Julio Jones. I'm assuming that that will probably be a repeat again this week, just because I don't think anybody with half a brain really wants Julio Jones going up against Jeremy Lane or Deshaun Shedd too often. But do you feel like Shedd and Lane are capable enough to sort of put the clamps down on the other Falcons' weapons? I know Shedd had a pretty solid game when he was matched up with Mohamed Sanu, but the Falcons have a lot more they have been able to capitalize a little bit more on faster playmakers like Taylor Gabriel. Is he the guy besides Julio that you think would give Seattle the most problems?
Yeah, Gabriel definitely scares me. I look at all those long touchdowns. That's definitely going to be a problem. And the truth is, Shedd and Lane have both given up really a bunch of big plays as of late. So I honestly, Gabriel and Sanu versus Shedd and Lane, that's a big mismatch in Atlanta's favor too. So let's pretend that they put Richard Sherman on Julio Jones for the entire game, and let's pretend, for the sake of argument, he totally shuts Julio down. Well, it doesn't matter, because Gabriel and Sanu are probably going to beat Lane and Shedd anyway. So because of that, I don't think it's going to be a 60-minute matchup of Sherman on Jones. They're going to have to mix up their coverage, make sure they keep the big plays off the board and keep guys in front of them and come up and make tackles. I know I said earlier they're going to blitz a lot, but you're also going to see a lot of zone coverage, a lot of just keeping guys in front of you, playing team defense and trying to come up and make the tackle.
I know Sherman doesn't follow receivers to the slot. Have you noticed that?
For a long time he didn't. When Gus Bradley and Dan Quinn were running this defense, he almost never left the left sideline. The last 2 years he's done it a lot more. It's probably about, 50-50 split maybe. That he stays on the left side and shadows the opponent's top receiver. But he will definitely follow guys into the slot. I know when they played the Jets, he followed Brandon Marshall everywhere. If Brandon Marshall went to the locker room, Richard Sherman probably would have followed him. So they're a lot more flexible now with how they use him. And I think part of that is because they have to be, because Deshaun Shedd is not as, quite frankly, he has not played as well as the other cornerbacks they've had at that spot opposite Richard Sherman over the past 3 or 4 years.
Minus Kerry Williams, of course.
Well, I meant the group.
The group
was in corners. The Byron Maxwell when he was good and Brandon Browner when he was good. Okay. That sort of thing.
I just remember that Kerry Williams experiment. Boy, what a disaster.
Well, it didn't work out well, but it cost them nothing. Or close to nothing. And Byron Maxwell was a disaster for Philadelphia, and he cost them a ton. So they got the better end of the two bad deals, I guess.
Yeah, if you're gonna strike out, do it for cheap, I guess, is the lesson there.
Yes. Which is also what they've done on the offensive line this year. So that has not worked out well. Moving to the other side of the ball for a bit. The Seahawks and offense have had some really good games this year, and they've had some really, really bad games. And usually in the really, really bad games, it's when the offensive line, they've at times this year looked as bad as I have ever seen an NFL offensive line look. They're losing one-on-one matchups. They're not working together. They're committing penalties. They're missing assignments. It's been a nightmare. And then the other half of the time, as long as they can function in a professional manner, they're not dominating, especially the tackles. They're never going to dominate one-on-one matchups there. But as long as they can work as a unit to a professional level, Seattle's skill players are actually really good. You just can't tell this year at times because they have to break tackles just to make the offense function.
So when you're looking at some of these matchups with the offensive line, because I've heard a lot of people talk about it, it's like a week to week sort of thing with this offensive line. Like some weeks they look functional, as you say, and other weeks they look like a absolute disaster. Do you have any sort of feel that, you know, what type of week this one's going to be as they try to match up with the Falcons defensive line?
It seems like after a lot of injuries and a lot of experimentation, it seems like they finally found a starting five that can work. And they were switching guys in and out of the lineup as late as mid-December. But there's a five-man unit that is George Fant at left tackle, Mark Lewinsky at left guard, Justin Britt at center, Jermaine Effetti at right guard, and Gary Gilliam at right tackle. And when those five guys have started, they're scoring, I think, 27 points a game. Any other combination, that average drops below 20. So that five-man unit basically adds a touchdown to the team's scoring output on average. So that's a pretty big difference. Of those five, the interior three are pretty standard. Now, they're all just Seahawks draft picks, one first-rounder this year. Justin Britt was a first-rounder in 2014 who has tried a couple of different positions and seems to have finally fit at center. And Mark Lewinsky was a draft pick, a third or fourth-round pick a few years ago, who has taken over a starting role this year. It's the tackles that are so weird. Right tackle Gary Gilliam, who was also the starting right tackle last year, he was a tight end in college who they've converted to a starting tackle now in the NFL. And George Fant at left tackle is the most surprising story in football, I think, this year. This is an undrafted rookie who played two games of college football and no games of high school football. So after two games of football in the past 8 years, he's now starting in the playoffs at left tackle. He was a basketball player at Western Kentucky, and when he realized he wasn't going to make the NBA, he thought, let me try this, give football a try. And he thought he'd be a pass rusher or maybe a tight end. And the Seahawks tried him out, and they said, we like what you can do at tackle. And they signed him to a free agent deal. And when Bradley Sowell crashed and burned as badly as most people expected Bradley Sowell to crash and burn, they stuck this guy who had never played football in before, and he's better, which I think says a lot about Bradley Sowell as well. But as long as those five guys have been on the field, that's when Seattle has been at their best.
It's kind of like Vinnyleva in Pittsburgh. I think he was a quarterback in college football, and now he's transitioned to playing left tackle somehow.
Oh, Vinnyleva. Yeah, he was. I remember watching an Army game. He may have been quarterback too, but in this game, he was a wide receiver. And he finished his college career, had his military service, and now here he is. Yeah, he's a starting tackle in the playoffs as well.
Yeah, I remember Villanueva in the Army. I remember thinking he's like 6'9", may not be good enough to play any position in the NFL, but put him on a football team and have him block field goals. That's a skill set right there.
That'll work. He's also got a commercial now, and his wife must also be about 6 feet tall. Or she's on a box in the commercial, one of the two.
You mentioned Effetti before. You think his long-term status, is that right guard, or do you see him converting into a tackle eventually?
I think he's picked to be a guard. I don't think, you know, you'll see a lot of guys like James Carpenter. They drafted him to be a tackle, ended up moving him inside the guard, and he played here for a few years, and he's with the Jets now. I think Effetti was a guard from day one. I think they meant for him to be a guard in day one. They've always said they liked his nastiness as a run blocker more than anything else. And, you know, he's a rookie, and rookies often improve, so I don't want to, you know, etch this in stone or anything, but he's missed a lot of blocks on the interior, and when I say missed, I mean he has launched, you know, I don't mean he's blown the block or not done it well. I mean he's fired out at human beings and missed them and not made contact entirely. And doing that as a tackle just seems like that's a really good way, especially if they put him to the right side, you know. That seems like a really good way to get quarterback hit and killed. So, no, he's a guard from the get-go.
Yeah, that's TJ Fleming's specialty.
The missed block?
Yeah.
Contact with air?
Yeah,
he lunges a lot, TJ Clemmie. That was the big issue with him. And I noticed that with Effetti. I thought, I'm trying to remember what game it was, maybe against Arizona. Again, I'm not sure if it was against Calais Campbell, but I remember him struggling quite a bit, which isn't surprising. But
I'm curious, Vincent, you know, Tom Cable's gotten a lot of heat from certain corners, just basically, and you mentioned it earlier when we were talking about how they've gone sort of cheap at the offensive line and basically taking all these raw pieces of dough and basically said, Cable, you turn them into NFL competent linemen. And do you feel like this sort of strategy has really, really hurt the Seahawks from where they were a couple of years ago, where, you know, they were on top of the world and they had not a great offensive line back then, but certainly one that was competent, and sort of this, you know, whatever you want to call the strategy has sort of really limited the team the last couple of years and sort of had them in a position where they are right now, where, you know, they're going into this game as an underdog against the Falcon team that they've beaten already this year.
Yeah. Well, first of all, this isn't directly answering your question, but a lot of people say that the team, it's not fair to Cable what the team has done, giving him with this talent level of offensive line. You know, for those, I've seen this stat a few times in the playoffs, so you guys have probably seen it too, but Seattle's cap hit for the all offensive linemen is like 50% of the next cheapest team at that position. So it's a true bargain basement unit. Deliberately, they went through it and said, let's spend the least amount of money as we can on the offensive line and see what we can do. Now, some people have the feeling that that's something management has done and then just drop it in Cable's lap. And I don't think that's accurate. I think it's much more likely that he has been a complicit in that plan from day one. I think he has told them, I'm a good enough coach that whatever you give me, I will make it work. So you guys go ahead and do cheap. I know he has said that he does not think college football is doing a good job of developing offensive linemen anymore. So no one's getting a good offensive line is what he thinks. And he's also that's part of why for a while they had a fetish for drafting defensive linemen and teaching them to play offensive line. And it's kind of the same thing they've done with Stanton Gilliam. You know, neither guy played offensive line in college. J.R. Sweezy, who's in Tampa Bay now, but he's another defensive lineman who they turned into an NFL starting offensive lineman. And his Cable's theory is that offensive linemen are being coached so badly in college that it's easier to start fresh with a completely raw prospect than to unlearn a guy's bad habits and teach him how to play lineman. Now, like I say, he's part of the whole scheme too. It's based on his input, so he deserves as much of the blame for its failures as anyone else. So it's not an easy question to answer because all that money, they say it on the offensive line, they threw it at the secondary where the starters of the team have been. They have the highest paid secondary in football. So, you know, you've got to cut corners somewhere, and they chose to cut corners on the offensive line like no one's ever seen before. And based on how it has worked out for 2016, I don't think it's going to happen again in 2017, and it'll be some changes made somehow.
I'm not sure if you saw this report, but I think it was Pete Carroll said that they were actually interested in Alex Mack back in March. Did you hear anything about that?
I've heard it recently. You know, it's kind of thing that comes out a year later. I don't know how they would have made that work because Alex Mack wasn't cheap. I'm sure they wanted him. I believe that. I'm just not sure what they would have done to make that work. There was talk even in training camp last year that Jimmy Graham might have been a salary cap cut. I don't know how close that is to coming true, but I can't imagine what this team would be doing right now without Jimmy Graham. So it's, you know, there's no easy answer to this. You can't just wave a magic wand and get talent at every position unless you're Nick Saban in Alabama. So you have to make some cuts somewhere.
I know obviously Jordan Nelson's had a pretty phenomenal season, but Jimmy Graham could be mentioned as a comeback player here. Did you expect him to return like this?
No, not like this at all. I think it's a slam dunk. He's a player of the year. I don't think people realize how hard it is to come back from a patellar tendon. You look at guys who suffer that injury, most of them don't come back at all. And Jimmy Graham has come back to be one of the two or three best tight ends in the game, behind, you know, maybe Travis Kelce and a healthy Gronkowski. But for what he's done to this team and the matchups he's created, the mismatches he's created on the field, like I say, I don't know where they would be without him, especially now with Tyler Lockett down for the year as well. It's been a two-man passing game between Baldwin and Graham for most of the year, and you take Graham away, and this would have been ugly.
I've seen some frustration within Seattle's fan base that Jimmy Graham isn't getting enough targets in the red zone. What do you think of that issue?
It's valid. It's definitely valid. Every once in a while, it was worse last year. last year they made this big trade for this guy and used him as he was an average Joe tight end. And you see him blocking and running plays and then leaving the field on passing downs. And you just thought, what are you doing? Why did you give up all this, all that you gave up to get this guy just to treat him like a guy? And this year it's been better. He's way more often used as a receiver and less often as a blocker. Although he's gotten better. He has some big problems blocking last year as well. But even still, there was a play, well, it was against Detroit. The fourth and goal touchdown catch Paul Richardson had, everyone remembers that because it was the amazing one-handed catch and also the face mask that didn't get called. People don't remember, on the play before that, on third and goal from the two, they kept in Jimmy Graham to block so they could throw a pass to Thomas Rawls. What in the hell sense does that make? I was just bewildered. I didn't get it at all. It's happened a few times. So they're still, I don't know if they're trying to outsmart themselves or being too cute. They needed, what you do with Jimmy Graham is you put him on the field, you have him, whoever he's matched up against, it's almost always a physical mismatch, and you just have him either run by them or turn around and box him out like it's a rebound. He had a play against San Francisco. Technically, it was a 42-yard catch. I can't call it that because there was nothing football-related about it at all. There was no route running. There was no timing with the quarterback. There was no open field running or tackle breaking. All he did was run down to just about the goal line, turn around, box out the defender, and grab the rebound. It was a 42-yard rebound. And they need to do that with him more, quite frankly.
49ers defense creating magic every week.
Yeah. There's that, too.
Well, I mean, you talked about Jimmy Graham, and something I've said on this podcast during this week is it's like, as you said, Jimmy Graham and Doug Baldwin are the two main go-tos. Maybe Richardson's on the rise up. But it seems like if the Falcons are going to win this game, they can only allow one of those two guys in Graham and Baldwin to sort of be productive. It's very unlikely that they'll be able to stop both of them. And it probably seems like, based off of how the Falcons have generally been against tight ends this year, Graham is the likelier of the two to go off. Do you feel like the Seahawks can find a way to get guys like Baldwin and Richardson going, particularly if the Falcons decide, which we expect them to do, to shadow him with Robert Alford, Baldwin in particular?
I think the biggest issue for Seattle on offense, and this is going to sound like a total cliche, and guys say this all the time, and they say it sometimes when it's not true, but it sounds good to say it, but I think in this case, Seattle really needs to be able to run the ball very well. And they haven't done that consistently all year, mainly because they've had trouble blocking guys, partly because their running backs have all been hurt. But they played, admittedly, a really bad run defense against Detroit, and they ran the ball like they haven't done all year. They had a touchdown drive where I think they ran the ball 11 times in a row, just pounding Detroit over and over and over again. And they haven't been close to able to do that all year. It's been quite a come down from the days of Marshawn Lynch running over guys. So I know Atlanta's run defense hasn't been great either, but I really think for Seattle the key is to run as much as they can. There's C.J. Procise might play in this game, although I don't think it's likely. But even without him, with Thomas Rawls, now it's Collins. They've got to get a bunch of carries in this game, really pound that defense to bring the safeties up, and then they can use play action and bootlegs, get Russell Wilson outside, and that give him a chance to hit Baldwin and Graham and maybe Richardson if Lightning can strike 2 weeks in a row. But yeah, in this particular game, I really do think the running game for Seattle is important.
Marcel Reese has been quite the asset, right?
Marcel Reese has been a big find for a veteran who is, it's funny. My wife has the Seahawks app on her phone. And so every time they sign anyone, she gets an alert and she asks me what this I can do. And my response is almost always, if he was any good, he wouldn't have been available to sign off the street. That was my reaction when they just signed Devin Hester a few weeks ago. I'm happy they signed Devin Hester. They need a guy who can field punts and make fair catches and not fumble the ball. And they didn't have that with Tyler Lockett down. But it's 2016, and I'm not expecting Devin Hester to single-handedly win games. So when they signed Reese, it was like, okay, they've got a fullback who can catch. Now that's fine. And, yeah, he's played very well. He's been multi-purpose. He's been a runner, receiver, and blocker. And for a team that's been way more shotgun free wide formations, and they've always been in that. They've always done a ton of that too. But in the past couple of weeks, we've seen way more I formations and fullback blocking, and it's worked out really well. And you know, cross your fingers, hope it works again this Saturday.
You talked about sort of the red zone issues, and I know Daryl Bevel has been under fire from a lot of Seahawk fans and observers this year for his play calling. Infamously, you know, Richard Sherman got into a shouting match with him on the sideline not that long ago. Do you feel like he can sort of, you know, you basically outline a plan that's pretty basic, game plan with, you know, run the football and then build off of that. But do you feel like, given Seattle's tendency this year to sort of struggle when they go on the road, do you feel like he can get the team and design a game plan that can get this team off to a good start against a Falcons defense that is, let's say, vulnerable to some struggles?
Mm-hmm. I think Bevel gets a lot of undeserved heat. And part of it is because the rest, you know, for the past 5 years or so, there hasn't been a lot to pick on the Seahawks. There hasn't been a lot to complain about. So the play calling, which hasn't always been perfect and has certainly been questionable at times, I think it gets more heat here than it might on another team, just because, like I say, most things on this team are going so well. And I think it's also, you know, it's probably not fair. I think he's – I mean, I just complained about that play where they didn't use Graham correctly, and that's on Bevel as much as anyone else. So, and he has a fascination with using Doug Baldwin on little screens and swings. You know, yak routes that you would use for a Tavon Austin or something. And he can do that. He's okay at that, but he's such a good wide receiver. I'd much rather see him just running routes and getting open and catching the ball. So he's got his quirks. He's got his faults. He's not perfect, but it's one of those things where if they fire Daryl Bevel, will they get better? And the answer is probably not. They'll probably take a step backwards. They'll probably find some other guy with some different set of weaknesses that he's not very good at. So I came down kind of on the glass half full side of that. I also, and this is purely speculation on my part, I want to emphasize this. This is not an inside scoop. This is not a secret tip. This is purely speculation. I get the feeling that, you know, Pete Carroll is I think he's the oldest coach in the NFL. He won't coach forever. And I think they've got a deal in place that Bevel will step up and take that job when Carroll finally calls it a career. So I don't think Daryl Bevel is going anywhere.
Wow. Okay. I do think it's wise that they're using more three-step drops for Russell Wilson, given how, I guess you'd say, how reliable the offensive line is. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah, that's definitely something they've done a lot more of. The first part of the year, they pretty much had to. It's funny. The numbers kind of evened out after a while, but through about week eight or so, his sack rate, Russell Wilson's sack rate, was actually the lowest of his career. And I was talking to someone who said, well, his sack rate is lower than ever. Clearly, he's getting his best blocking ever. And I wanted to slap him for saying something so ridiculous. I don't know if they'd ever actually watched the game. But that was not a reflection of the blocking. It was a reflection of what the offense is doing, which is, you know, three-step, one read, throw it to your hot route, or chuck it out of bounds. And it was something, and they did a little bit of it last year too, especially when Russell took off in the last half of last year. But it's not what you think of when you think of Russell Wilson. You're thinking play action, deep drop. If the first guy's not open, wait, make a guy miss, make another guy miss, scramble, and then throw to some guy who has made his fourth cut and get the first down. So it's kind of weird to watch. It's not the Russell Wilson we are used to seeing.
Yeah, because I noticed that against Detroit a lot. Like, obviously, you mentioned those swing passes to Baldwin, and I just wonder if Wilson's taken a lot of punishment this year, because I thought a lot of the sacks that Detroit had on last Saturday was on Wilson. Like, there was one with Ziggy Ansah where he just ran right into him. Do you think the constant pressure is starting to rattle Wilson a bit?
It's possible. That was definitely a weird game in that it was the exact opposite of every Seahawks game this year, where Wilson generally had time to pass, but he couldn't, couldn't find anyone open downfield. And certainly some of those sacks were absolutely his fault, where he had ample time to get rid of the ball. And like you see, the one time he ran right into the defender. So it was a head trip to watch. And then by the end, they made some big plays in the fourth quarter to kind of show you the passing game was still alive, but it was a head scratcher, that's for sure.
I'm curious about Paul Richardson because he's the one guy that gives me a little pause among the skill position players. Like, I feel like the Falcons can sort of match up with him, with everybody else. I feel like Alfred can keep Baldwin in check. You know, I think Graham will do what he does. As long as the Falcons can keep him out of the end zone, I think they'll be fine there. And I'm optimistic that they can do something against the run to prevent Rawls from going off like he did with Detroit. But I do feel like Richardson will have some favorable matchups, considering that Jalen Collins and Brian Poole aren't necessarily guys that you would say should be matched up with a guy that can run a 4-4. Obviously, I know Richardson's, they're not going to run their offense through Richardson, and he'll get a handful of targets. But I do feel like he's a guy that he could potentially take advantage of those targets, particularly down the field. What are your expectations, especially coming off of a game like Detroit, which was, you know, at least to public eyes, was sort of a breakout game with all the spectacular highlight reel catches he had?
Yeah, he was a second-round pick in 2014. And his first 2 years were both just ruined by injuries over and over again. And we all kind of thought, well, they took a shot in the guy, but he's too small and he can't stay healthy and it's not going to work out. And plus, he got passed on the depth chart by Tyler Lockett, who has a lot of the same attributes but seemed to be a much better receiver. And then Lockett goes down with a broken leg. Richardson gets his second, third, fourth chance, whatever you want to call it. And he made a bunch of big catches against Detroit, but let me take that back. He made a few big catches against Detroit, but since they were all highlight plays, I think people have kind of overreacted to what they were. He caught three passes. It's just that all three passes were great and big plays. So, yeah, if I was Atlanta, I would be concerned about him, but still a distant third behind Baldwin and Graham. The biggest question is, has he passed Jermaine Kearse on Seattle's depth chart? And Kearse has had an awful year. I just looked this up before the game. As you guys know, Atlanta has two really good running backs who are also really good receivers. Tevin Coleman has, I think he has 8 20-yard catches this year as a backup running back. Jermaine Kearse, as a starting wide receiver, has 7. And I think that tells you all you need to know about these two offenses. So that'll be interesting to see. For a lot of years, they stuck with Kearse because he was a really good blocker and they were mostly a running team. But they haven't been nearly as much of a running team for most of this year. And as a receiver, Richardson is certainly a lot more dangerous, even if he's not necessarily as physical.
I thought Kearse would be a useful option in the red zone, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
They honestly, if you go back for the one thing they have not done for most of this reign where they've been one of the NFL's best teams, they have not consistently been a really good red zone offense, running or passing for most of that time. I don't know why. I thought when Jimmy Graham arrived, that would solve everything, and it hasn't. Kearse's big thing for a lot of years was all of his touchdowns would be go-ahead scores in the fourth quarter. That happened in back-to-back NFC Championship games. His most famous catch, of course, was the bobbling catch he had in the Super Bowl to set up the finish against New England. But he was a guy who would be invisible for long stretches and then make the one game-winning play, almost like a Mariano Rivera as a receiver, where he wouldn't do much, but what he did would be so important, it would help you win.
It's a pretty crazy style clash. You have one of the more worst offenses in the red zone, and the Falcons, I'm not sure what the stats are saying these days, but for the majority of the season, the Falcons were the worst red zone defense in the league, right, Aaron?
Yeah, they still are.
Oh, okay. So.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. I guess my question for you guys would be, we kind of talked about what what you're worried about as far as playing the defense against Seattle. Is there anything, because like I say, you've had the pleasure of watching the NFL's best offense for most of this year, or what was, for all this year. Is there anything that does concern you about Seattle beyond the pass rush, which I guess we talked about that already?
I would say probably Wagner and KJ. I think they're right up there with Kuechly and Davis as the best linebacker duo in the league. You saw Wagner, especially on that screen, just shed that block, and Atlanta does like to use screens, whether it's with Freeman, Coleman, or Gabriel, and both linebackers, they know how to erase plays. Their range is incredible. So I would say probably those. Obviously, Sherman, Julio, that's going to be a fun matchup. But I would say, yeah, Ryan Wagner doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, I'm with Alan on that. I think, you know, Seattle's front seven and their linebacker play. I think Atlanta is best offensively when they can sort of do all the things that they want to do. And when they get a little bit one-dimensional, it hurts them. You know, they can still be effective, but they're not quite as potent. And I think being able to run the football, which they weren't really able to do in that first matchup against Seattle, and I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, the great play of Seattle's linebackers. They just seem to be so good at shedding blocks and disengaging from blockers, which is normally in the NFL, that's a mismatch in favor of the offense. And I think if Seattle can sort of put the clamps on Atlanta's running game, then I think that puts their pass rush in a more favorable situation, because Atlanta gets a little bit more one-dimensional. And we've seen with the Falcons offensive line, even though that they're good, there's been too many times, and that Seattle game was a perfect example. There's been too many times where Matt Ryan has been, you know, hit a lot this year. I think he's been hit maybe like 110 times this year, which is like in the top five in the league or something like that. So it's one of those things where like that worries me, but I do feel like the Falcons, you know, other than that, I don't think there's a whole lot to be worrisome, unless Seattle's running game really does get going in the same way it did against Detroit, where they can just control the clock and keep Atlanta's offense off the field.
Okay. Well, I guess that about covers everything. Should we do predictions?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely like to hear yours, given that it's so bizarre seeing all these analysts favor Atlanta, because over the years, whenever these two teams play, you constantly hear Seattle should win by double digits.
Well, that may have been true in 2013 or 14 or even 15. This year, I think, Seattle, I can't pick Seattle against a great offense when they're missing their best defender. And with apologies to Michael Bennett and Richard Sherman and Wagner and all the rest, I think Earl Thomas is the best defender they have. I do have questions about Atlanta's defense, but I think Atlanta's offense will overcome them. And maybe a different story in Seattle, but they lost the game in Seattle when they lost to Arizona in week 16. So that's their own fault. So to make a long story short, I'm going to go with the Falcons, and I will say 30-27.
Oh, wow. I'm actually going to go 30-26. And I do think Hauschka is going to miss a big field goal, and it's going to put Seattle under pressure those last 2 minutes, where they're, instead of converting a field goal, they have to go in the end zone. So yeah, I'm going to go 30-26.
That's possible.
Yeah, I've noticed Hauschka has been very sketchy this year, which is really shocking.
It's not been a good year on extra points or field goals. And frankly, John Ryan, the punter, hasn't had much of a great year either.
Hopefully they're not trying any fake punts for this playoff game like they tried against Minnesota.
The one against Minnesota was funny because I don't know if it was a called fake punt or a bad snap in a panic, but either way, you can go back the year before when Ryan had the touchdown on the fake field goal, so you never know.
Yeah, they're so unpredictable, Seattle. But yeah, I'm going to go 30-26, although, it's going to be a very nerve-wracking game.
I'm going to go 27-23 Atlanta. Like, I feel like, I think you broke it down, Vincent. It's an interesting game because the way Seattle's going to win it is the traditional way that they typically win, which is they're going to play great defense and they're going to run the football down your throat. And I think, you know, the shift has been they're not quite as good at those things as they have been in the past. And so I don't necessarily know if they have enough there to win the game, but I do certainly think that they can slow the Falcons down somewhat and make it at least close in the end. So 27-23 Falcons.
Well, there you go. We're all in really close agreement about that one.
Yeah. I assume you have to be at least somewhat optimistic, given that, look, this is still Seahawks. They've been a perennial powerhouse for 4 years, and they still have stars on both sides of the ball.
Oh, I've got hope. I've got hope. Believe me, I've seen this team win games they should lose, I've seen them excel in the postseason. They've won at least one playoff game now 5 years in a row. There's only two or three other teams that could say that. So they've won before. They've won in the playoffs before. They've won playoff games on the road before. they have won playoff games on the road when they've fallen behind before. So I'm going to have hope for this game, unless it's a total blowout, which is not impossible. But I'm going to have hope for this game. As long as they've got the ball down by just a score or two, there's going to be a chance.
There you go. Vince, where can people find you on Twitter? And if you want to share anything else?
Absolutely. You can follow me on Twitter. Follow the show on Twitter, at Locked Seahawks. You can follow me personally on Twitter, at FO_VVerhi, which at some point I will change that to something more easy to say. But you can also follow my... You can also follow my work at footballoutsiders.com. And let's see, what else? Facebook.com/LockedOnSeahawks and LockedOnSeahawks@gmail.com.
All right. Vincent, we appreciate you giving us your time and sharing your insights and talking a little football with us.
All right, that was fun. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right.
Thanks, Vincent. Have a good night.
All right, everyone, that's going to do it for today. I want to ask you all to follow the show on Twitter, at LockedSeahawks. You can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/LockedOnSeahawks and drop us a line at LockedOnSeahawks@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. That's going to do it for today. Thank you for listening, and go Hawks.
You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily podcast on the Seattle Seahawks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What you doing?
Ran out of space on my phone, so I'm deleting some stuff. Bye, singing dog. Bye, goal.
I pronounce you.
Bye, wedding ceremony.
Stop. At Metro PCS, you get 2 free phones with twice as much memory.
Really?
Don't say bye to your memories. Switch to Metro PCS and get 2 free LG K20 Plus phones with 32 gigs when you switch 2 lines. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.